On a Monday, you're with us for the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about legal challenges brought by the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. That's a conservative law and policy organization. We're looking closely at several suits, in particular, Governor Evers' partial veto powers that create new laws by altering language. We'll also look at how standardized test scores are released for public and voucher schools. And we start with how voter rolls are purged and updated and when that happens. Are you familiar with the suit against the Wisconsin Elections Commission? Do you support it? What questions do you have about how the voter rolls are maintained? We're at 800-642-1234. Rick Essenberg is president and general counsel for the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. Rick, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me on this morning.
So last week, your firm filed a suit against the Wisconsin Elections Commission. What does the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty consider unlawful about how the Elections Commission goes about maintaining these voter rolls?
All right. Well, you know, we have a problem in the United States in that there are a lot of inaccurate or outdated registrations on our voter rolls, not just in Wisconsin, but in every state. It makes it harder to run elections. It's harder to anticipate what the turnout will be. And it does provide at least an opportunity for fraud, because there are a lot of people on the rolls that are not going to be voting at the location at which they're registered. And so because of that, both federal and state law have attempted to address the obligation to keep those rolls as accurate as they possibly can be. And state law says that when the Wisconsin Election Commission receives reliable information that a person may have moved, that it's supposed to send a postcard telling them, look, we think you no longer live at the address that you're registered. And if you still do, you need to return this postcard within 30 days in order to maintain your registration at that address. If the person fails to return the postcard, then their registration at that address is deactivated. Now, in Wisconsin, that doesn't mean that they won't be able to vote at that address, because if they go to the polls on Election Day and they find that their registration has been deactivated, we have same-day voter registration in Wisconsin, in which you can register with a wide variety of information that indicates your address. And in almost all cases, that voter will be able to then re-register and cast their ballot. So the Wisconsin Election Commission nevertheless has determined that it's not going to follow state law in this regard. It's not going to remove voters who have not returned that postcard until they haven't voted in one or more election cycles. Now, that is the law, the federal requirement, or at least it's close to the federal requirement, for states that don't have same-day registration. But because we do have same-day registration in Wisconsin, we are exempted from that federal requirement, because we've got a backstop that other states don't have.
Well, I want to pause. I want to pause right there, going back to voter fraud. Do you think Wisconsin is more vulnerable to voter fraud with the process that is in place right now?
So I have always thought that that same-day registration does present an opportunity for voter fraud. I remember being at a polling place, I think during the 2004 election, and there were eight lawyers at that polling place, and people could have been cheating left and right, and the lawyers would not have been able to do anything about it, because same-day registration in Wisconsin allows you to register and cast a ballot using easily fabricated information. In that sense, I think that's the real value of Wisconsin's photo ID requirement, because it at least requires you to produce a government ID that has to, you know, at least to identify who you are. Now, people will say, well, but nobody engages in voter fraud, right? Nobody would cheat in an election. I find that assertion to be implausible. Human beings, most human beings will not cheat, but some human beings will cheat on almost anything. They cheat on their taxes, they cheat on their spouses, they engage in identity theft, identity fraud, and because of that, we usually want to keep in place reasonable guardrails in order to assure that fraud doesn't exist. And we can all agree that the franchise is important. We can all agree that the integrity of our elections are important. And so it seems to me that in order to ensure that is so, that our elections, that the franchise is respected, that people's votes are not diluted by fraudulent votes, and to ensure that people have public confidence in the integrity of our elections, which are often very, very close, taking reasonable steps to safeguard against fraud seems to be a reasonable way to go. And Wisconsin has done that through the process that I've just described, at least with respect to maintaining the accuracy of the voter rolls. It's very disappointing that the Election Commission will not even take this modest step to ensure the integrity of our elections.
Let's pause right there with Rick Essenberg. He's an attorney with the group Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. You can join in. What questions do you have about how voter rolls are maintained here in Wisconsin? Do you think voter rolls should be purged more or less frequently? We're at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. So in 2017, the Wisconsin Elections Commission sent mailings to 342,000 potentially relocated voters. In this case, the commission did remove voters who didn't respond to the mailer within 30 days. 46,000 of those voters had to be reactivated at the same address. Does this signify that the 30-day window may be too short and cause unnecessary deactivations, Rick Essenberg?
Well, it was about, looking at, those numbers, there's about a 93%. You could read them to have about a 93% accuracy rate. There is no anti-fraud mechanism which is going to be perfect. Any of us who have a credit card, have sort of experienced a situation where our credit card company will hold up a charge because they're concerned about potential fraud. And you're always going to be able to hypothesize a situation in which any type of ballot security measure could go awry. But the important thing here is that Wisconsin has a backstop. You can, if you are removed from the polls, you don't know it, you ignore the postcard, you don't send it back, you don't check your mail, I don't know, whatever happens.
And I've gotten one of those postcards. It can certainly get lost in the shuffle of other mail around it.
Could that's possible. That could happen. Again, nothing is going to work perfectly, but you will still be able to vote, because when you go to the polling place on election day and you find out that your registration is deactivated, you will be able to re-register to vote right there at that moment and cast your ballot. That's different than a lot of other states, and it may be appropriate in those other states to be more circumspect about and slower in cleaning up the voter rolls. But we don't need to do that in Wisconsin because we have that backstop. That's why we are not subject to the National Voter Registration Act, and that's why state law provides what it does. And, we can argue about the policy of this all we want. We can argue about whether this is a good idea or a bad idea, but it is the law. And if you don't like the law, the solution for that is not to have the Wisconsin Election Commission ignore it.
Well, I got to pause right there with Rick Essenberg, and you can join in 800-642-1234. Back in a moment on the Ideas Network. It is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and we're examining recent legal challenges brought by the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. The law firm has sued in regards to voter rolls, And are you familiar with the suit against the Wisconsin Elections Commission? Do you support it? Join in 800-642-1234. Attorney Rick Essenberg stays with us. He's president of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. So, you know, the Wisconsin Elections Commission has said that they have the authority to wait longer than 30 days because another state law allows them to create rules about how to maintain the voter rolls. So do we have conflicting state laws on the books?
No, I don't think that the authorization of the Election Commission to promulgate rules means that it can alter the law that the legislature has passed. Whenever an agency creates rules, fidelity to the statutory law is always going to be a test of that rule. And if you think about it for a minute, that is moored in our separation of powers, right? That we learned in civics, or we learned it on Schoolhouse Rock, however we learned it. We know that the legislature makes the law, and the executive, and the Election Commission is part of the executive, they carry the law out. And they do not have the power to legislate. They do not have the power to change state law. And the fact that they assert that they do is extremely disturbing.
Well, let's take a call now. Ron joining us from Lancaster. Hi, Ron.
Hi. Without getting too into detail, I just want to say I've got some pretty intimate knowledge of how the post office works. And there's these things called certified letters. You've got 15 days. You need a signature. It's very official. You get two notifications from the post office, and many people, even though their house, their car, their insurance is on the line, don't make it in 15 days. To think that somebody is going to take a postcard that could be mistaken for junk mail and reply in 30 is just not realistic, besides the fact that I don't see the game for removing people just to put them back on the voter rolls when they show up because it was in error. Seems like effort and futility.
Ron, thanks for the call. Rick, in effort and futility, what do you see there?
Well, first of all, I think Ron is incorrect in suggesting that people are removed from the rolls only to be added on. The fact of the matter is the overwhelming majority of people who do not return these postcards do not show up to vote at the registration because the information is accurate. They have moved and they should be removed from the rolls. Now, so that small percentage that do show up, I agree. It's possible that somebody can overlook a postcard. That could happen. But they have the ability to re-register at the polls. And in fact, that's what's happened in the past. And so, under federal law, like if we were subject to if we didn't have same day voting registration, then under federal law, we would have to wait and see whether these people voted in some subsequent federal elections, at least with respect to an election where a federal candidate is on the ballot. But we don't need to do that here in Wisconsin because we have this backstop. We have a very generous and liberal, if you will, same-day registration system, which will allow somebody to re-register and cast a vote.
Let's go to Gary now in Iron River. Good morning, Gary.
Yeah, good morning, Kate and Mr. Essenberg. It seems to me that if Mr. Essenberg is stating the facts correctly, it's a cut and dried situation. We have laws. Laws need to be enforced. If they're not enforced, then there's something going haywire. If there's a considered belief that the law is wrong, the law should be changed. But yes, I support the lawsuit, and not enforcing laws is one of these things that leads to contempt of the laws, and that doesn't get us anywhere. It gets us to anarchy.
Well, Rick, do you see a pretty clear path forward for this suit? Do you think that you'll win?
Yeah, I think we have a very, very strong case, and I think the caller makes an important point. We live in a world right now where both sides, people on the left and people on the right, sort of have the attitude that when we're in power, we should use it any way that we possibly can. And so when Barack Obama was president, the Democrats looked the other way when he exceeded his executive authority and tried to remake the law or ignore the law in various ways. And Democrats did that because they liked what President Obama was doing. Now we flash forward and Donald Trump is president of the United States. And unfortunately, too many Republicans are doing the same thing. They're looking away when, you know, President Trump acts in ways which exceed his executive authority. My suggestion is that we all make sure that we agree on what the rules are. And the rules in this country is the legislature makes the law and the executive administers the law. The law here, whether we like it or not, and I think the law is quite defensible, provides for the removal of these voters with the opportunity to re-register. Well, we ought to follow that law.
We're talking with Rick Essenberg, an attorney with the group, the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. You can join in as we move on to partial vetoes. What do you think about the level of transparency in Wisconsin government? Should public officials have to oblige all public records requests? Join in 800-642-1234. So as we move on here, Rick, the Wisconsin Supreme Court is taking up your case that challenges Governor Evers' use of the partial veto. Why does this warrant judicial review? This law has been on the books since 1930.
Well, the law has been misinterpreted by the court since 1930. What the Constitution says is that the governor may approve or disapprove an appropriation item in whole or in part. And what happened is that governors, and it's not just Tony Evers, prior Democratic governors have done it, Jim Doyle, prior Republican governors have done it, Tommy Thompson, they've all done it. And what they've done is they've interpreted that language to mean that they not only have the power to approve or disapprove an appropriation item, but in various ways they can strike words and they can rewrite the law. The Constitution does not provide for that. The words of the Constitution do not say that. If you look at the history of the constitutional provision, that is not what was intended. And the courts have allowed our state governors, both Democrats and Republicans, over the years to distort the Constitution. And at various points, the voters have tried to straighten things out. We amended the Constitution to eliminate the old Vanna White veto. That's when Tommy Thompson would strike out letters and make new words. And we amended the Constitution to eliminate the Vanna White, not the Frankenstein.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, where Governor Doyle would, you know, go for pages and pages and strike out and take a word here and a number there, and he'd build a new law. And that's, again, this is inconsistent with the separation of powers that I talked about earlier, where the legislature makes the law and the executive administers it. And the governor has the power to say, no, we're not going to spend this item. He has the power to say, we spend less on this item than you appropriated. But he should not have, and the Constitution does not give him, by its language or history, the authority to take an appropriation for school buses, including those that operate on alternative fuel, and turn it into an appropriation for electrical vehicle charging stations, which is what Governor Evers did.
Well, what about a veto override in this situation?
Well, a veto override is a tough thing, right? I mean, you got to get 2/3 of the vote, and normally, neither party has enough seats in the legislature to do that. The point is that a veto override should not be necessary here, because the veto that is described in the Constitution, which talks about approval or disapproval of an appropriation item, does not mean that you get to rewrite the law. And because you don't have the power to rewrite the law, there should be no need for a veto override. You've exceeded your power. We don't get to the question of a veto override. So we've asked the court to reexamine the way in which the courts have interpreted this constitutional language, and it has agreed to do so, and we'll see what the court does.
Yeah, I mean, it's been before the high court before, and I'm wondering if this a problem with appropriations bills? If your governor approves 90% of a state budget, but there's 10% they don't agree with, why can't they strike the 10% and move the budget forward?
Well, again, it depends upon what you mean by striking. If the striking is that the governor doesn't want to spend $1 million for Project A and simply eliminates that appropriation item, the governor clearly has the authority to do that, and we wouldn't challenge that. But if the governor takes the $1 million that is appropriated for purpose A and changes it into an appropriation for purpose B, that goes beyond approval or disapproval. That's changing. That's different. And the Constitution does not, if you read the language of the Constitution, it does not give him the authority. The courts have misinterpreted that language over the years. And given the creativity of the staff who have worked for governors over the years, I think it's time to get the interpretation right rather than rely on the voters to have to keep coming back and amending the Constitution saying, no, we didn't mean you could do that. We didn't mean you could do that. You know, I think we need to return to the original understanding and the clear language of the constitutional text.
Rick, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Take care.
Attorney Rick Essenberg is president of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. Coming up, it's news, and the State Capitol Report continues with Democratic Senate Minority Leader Jennifer Schilling on the line. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is a State Capitol Report on the Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. You have a line to State Senator Jennifer Schilling here on the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're looking back on the debates this fall, getting her view on what happened. We're looking ahead to what she wants to get done next year. How do you want to see state lawmakers come together on issues like gun control, like vaping, marijuana, CWD? We're at 800-642-1234. Jennifer Schilling is a Democrat representing Wisconsin's 32nd Senate District, which includes La Crosse. She's also the Senate Minority Leader. State Senator Schilling, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thank you so much for having me.
So around our dinner table, we do high-low each night. Like, what was your high? What was your low? And I'm wondering if you could do high-low for us when you look back at the debate over the last fall floor session. What was the high for you? What was the low?
Unfortunately, there are more lows than highs. However, I will say one of the highs was an effort, and it's one of the few bills that has been passed this session, was duty disability. It was a bipartisan bill. Law enforcement was heavily behind it that allows if a police officer is killed in the line of duty, extending health care coverage to their family, you know, after they've passed on. And so I think as we look at those who put their lives at risk every day, that was one area that we could find bipartisan support on. But the lows have been numerous. I think, you know, 2 weeks ago when it kind of came to a crescendo with the rejection of Secretary designee Brad Paff being rejected for confirmation in the state Senate. We've just seen the incivility continues to rise in the legislature, and we have met less than once a month in this year. I think we've met 9 times. There is a lot of unfinished business. We have adjourned for the year in the state Senate and the Assembly and won't be back on the floor until mid-January. And we look at the bills that have bipartisan support, a homelessness package, working towards the T21, Tobacco 21 legislation. We have a lot of things that are unfinished on our plate, and just the tone and the finger pointing and the hyper-partisanship that is just slow playing Governor Evers and his administration this year has been really frustrating. And at the beginning in January, I talked about sort of my Republican colleagues going through the 5 stages of grief after the election. That first year, you know, angry and you're in denial and you go to depression, bargaining, and finally acceptance. And I feel like our colleagues in the majority party are really kind of stuck in the anger and denial and just will not give Governor Evers any kind of victory or win on issues. Bipartisan efforts are very difficult to come by. And I think the people of Wisconsin certainly deserve better.
Well, let's look at PATH. Republicans voted to fire Governor Evers' Agriculture Department Secretary, Brad PATH. The governor said the vote was done for political and amoral purposes. What is your perspective there? What happened?
Well, Brad PATH, and certainly I'll start, every governor has that opportunity to appoint their people to those positions. And I have confirmed, I think in only recent memory, I have 2 no votes against any gubernatorial appointment. Brad Paff was undeniably qualified with his background and experience in agriculture, was supported through the committee process with 9-0 unanimous vote. 5 Republicans voted for him, and we saw become very political. And unfortunately, that is sort of what is happening in the legislature. It is partisan. It's paralysis by partisanship. And as my colleagues can point to an ag siting rule that the administration, that the department was pushing, it was in fact a rule that was started by the previous administration, Republican Governor Scott Walker and his ag secretary. And so it's become kind of a breakdown of communication. And Brad, unfortunately, was kind of the first example of it, where now I feel like the secretaries really serve at the pleasure of the Republican Senate rather than of the governor. And I hope we can get these confirmations back on track. And I hope we can, you know, dial back some of the rhetoric that's happened.
Do you anticipate there are more of these firings ahead?
Well, the majority leader has indicated that some of the other secretaries have some problems within the caucus. And I just hope that we can sort of step back from the ledge and reestablish some communication, try to find a way that we build some small T trust with the administration and the legislature, and really look at the people that Governor Evers have appointed as secretary, look at their background, their experience, what they have done in the first, 11 months on the job, and recognize you may not always agree with these people, but that they have the experience, they have the knowledge, and that they have a vision for their department.
We're talking with Democratic Senate Minority Leader Jennifer Schilling of La Crosse, and you can join in. How do you want to see lawmakers working together on things like gun control? Do you see a compromise? Has teen vaping impacted your community? What policies would you like to see to address youth vaping? What bills would you like to see passed? Join in 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. So your priority heading into the fall floor period was really centered on gun laws. Republicans quickly shut down the special session Governor Evers called to deliberate gun control legislation. What is a Democrat's next move here to push these measures forward?
Well, I was really pleased to see the leadership and the support of Governor Evers and Attorney General Josh Call pushing for a special session. It's really been the first time in 8 years that we have had a proactive approach to gun violence in our communities. I think it's important that we offer more than just thoughts and prayers to those families and those communities that are dealing with gun violence. In the weeks that we were basically in special session for about 30 seconds, gaveled in, gaveled out, there have been more shootings in communities and schools. And for me, it's also a personal issue that I have talked about. Both my parents were murdered in 1993 in our family restaurant in Illinois. And so I have talked about the need to do reasonable gun safety and gun reform issues, as far as it includes closing the gun show loophole, looking at, this wasn't one of the bills, but a 48-hour, waiting period, the ERPO Extreme Risk Protection Order. And it was just really dismissive of the majority party to say, look, we're basically going to ignore this call, and that there is no effort to sit down and try to find some kind of reasonable measure that we can find some common ground. And it does not have to be a party line issue. That I know that there are good people in the legislature who want to do the right thing. There are responsible gun owners in this state who support these efforts. And it was just really disheartening, and it was really brash of the majority party to spend as little time on it as they did. And, there were groups that were there supporting it that day in the Capitol. We received letters of support, and we need, I don't know what the breaking point is, but we definitely need to look at how we can address gun violence and prevent it, and some common sense efforts like not allowing people with domestic abuse and restraining orders to access weapons.
Republicans have been supporting more mental health initiatives. Is that way to go about this?
I think that is one effort. That is not the only cure for this. It certainly is not the cure because we continue to see it. And so looking at mental health support and treatment is one avenue to look at, but there are other things as well as we should be doing. And so I do applaud those efforts to make sure that we are looking at treatment services and availability, but also to think that that is the only avenue and that is the only answer to gun violence in our communities, I think is really short-sighted.
Let's move on to vaping here. President Trump is said to be considering moving forward on a plan to restrict flavored vaping products. U.S. Senator Ron Johnson is urging him not to. Where do we stand as a state here from state lawmakers? Do you think this kind of ban would put a dent in teen vaping?
Well, there actually is legislation going through the process, T21, Tobacco 21, where there is bipartisan effort at both the Senate level to raise the age for sale, purchase, and possession of tobacco products and vaping products. We would raise it the age to 21 in an effort to combat the high rates of teenage vaping. And the tobacco companies are pushing this and recognize that at 18, young people can, you know, right now could purchase it, but then sell it or distribute it to, you know, kids under 18 through school or siblings or whatever. So I think that that is one of the efforts that I wish we would find some bipartisan support and move on that before we adjourn for the year. And I do think there aren't enough studies out there that vaping is dangerous right now. We have the lung damage that is being done that I certainly think that we need to be looking at that age, raising it, and just making sure that tobacco products are, you know, purchased by legal means of 21, where they are then deemed as adults and can make some better choices.
Yeah, a number of teens in Wisconsin were hospitalized with severely damaged lungs after vaping. Is this sending alarm bells to state lawmakers?
Well, as we have seen between 2017 and 2018 alone, the use of vapor products by high school students have increased by 78% and by 48% among middle school students. So they are getting their hands on it. They are experiencing with it. We don't understand the complete dangers and harm that it is doing. So I think we should be looking at ways to tackle this issue. And I think it's interesting that we have this rush to protect young people on vaping, but yet at the same time, we are reluctant to do something about gun violence in our schools and protecting students in that fashion. So I think there's a way that we could do both.
We're talking with State Senator Jennifer Schilling on the State Capitol Report. Is chronic wasting disease an issue on your mind? We'll talk about it. 800-642-1234. Back in a moment with Senate Minority Leader Jennifer Schilling on the Ideas Network. On a Monday, it is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're touching on a number of policy issues, including the future of medical marijuana legislation. In all, 33 states and D.C. have authorized medical use of cannabis. A bipartisan group of Wisconsin lawmakers proposed legalizing it for medical use. And another group of Democratic lawmakers introduced a bill last month to decriminalize possession of less than 28 grams. But Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald remains opposed. So what do you think Wisconsin could gain or lose by legalizing medical marijuana? Have you seen its impact in other states? We're at 800-642-1234. Senate Minority Leader Jennifer Schilling stays with us. State Senator, before we move on to medical marijuana, let's look a moment here at CWD. Your name is on several proposals related to chronic wasting disease. One would place containers around the state for hunters to dump their deer carcasses in, and the bill would also designate money to educate hunters about CWD. No Republicans have signed on to this bill as of yet. Is that true?
Well, Those bills have been, yes, introduced and circulated, certainly hoping that there is support in committees once we have hearings on these. Being in western Wisconsin, deer hunting season is, we're on the eve of it. The people are really excited. It's a boost for our small towns economically. It is part of our Wisconsin heritage. People suffer from buck fever during that 9-day gun season. And thanks to my colleague, Senator Patty Schachner, and Senator Jeff Smith really taking the lead on introducing chronic wasting disease legislation to look at what we need to be doing for increased ability for testing, for those availability of those kiosks around the state, that it is, we have legislation, Healthy Hunt, Healthy Herd, that has been introduced by Representative Katrina Shanklin, that is looking at what we need to be doing for chronic wasting disease. That it is, several years ago, we talked about it a lot. It has not gone away. It's kind of gone on the back burner, but we need to bring that back up to the forefront because it could be really devastating to our local economies and certainly in the hunting communities if we don't get a handle on chronic wasting disease and what is happening to our herd, and working with the Department of Natural Resources to test and really work to eradicate CWD.
But Governor Evers has said he wants to see what other states do in their research, what it turns up before he spends money on additional CWD research. Is this the route the legislature would go as well?
There are studies that have been done in other states. We can look to see what they have recommended. But again, my colleagues are saying we need to be testing. We need to be making those kiosks and those testing sites available. Just last week, as I was traveling on a road here in western Wisconsin, that we had seen that there are those testing sites will be available. So I think we need to be vigilant on this, and we don't have a lot of more days in our legislative floor period before we adjourn. I think we're supposed to be until April. The Republicans have us scheduled for one day in January, one day in February. But there is time. We are now on the eve of this hunt, as I had said. But as we look ahead to future deer seasons, how we need to be addressing this, I think, is important.
We're talking with State Senator Jennifer Schilling. She's a Democrat representing Wisconsin's 32nd Senate District, which includes La Crosse. You can join in 800-642-1234. On what do you think Wisconsin could gain from legalizing medical marijuana? How have you seen it impact other states? What issues are in your mind for Senator Jennifer Schilling? Well, let's look at medical marijuana. You co-authored a bill that was introduced last month that would legalize medical marijuana. What kind of economic impact do you envision this having on Wisconsin?
Well, first, I think that lawmakers' position on marijuana has been evolving. I've been in the legislature for some time, and I think I've seen my colleagues move on their support of the use of marijuana, medically marijuana. It's a medically compassionate bill. I remember at that time it was Representative Mark Pocan. Now Congressman Pocan had talked about being medically compassionate for care and allowing medicinal marijuana. I know that Senator Erpenbach has been a leader on this issue, and I think as we look at studies, as more states have moved to that point of legalizing medicinal marijuana, the comfort that it offers patients with chronic disease or with just chronic pain, we have seen that, and it's pretty moving testimony when individuals come forward to the committee and testify on it. So the Senate, under the current majority leader, does not feel that this is something that his caucus could support. I think there's been some indication in the Assembly that there could be support to pass this.
Right. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss has indicated that he's open to marijuana being legalized for medical purposes.
Yes. And I think as we look at, neighboring states here in the upper Midwest, what they are doing on that, if Wisconsin becomes an island. And so, again, that is one that I wish we could find bipartisan support and take the politics out of it and really look to put people and their health care and their coverage, their care before politics, and looking to ease some of that chronic pain and recognizing kind of the support that it has within the communities.
Well, before we move on to the next bill, there's been some mention in the Republican-led legislature that there could be a tax cut in the works. Do Democrats support such a move?
Well, the devil's always in the details, and so who it's targeted towards. If it is using one-time money, which I don't think is the most responsible way to do that, we've had the battle of the tax cuts early in 2019 when Republicans had a bill that I believe the governor vetoed. The governor had one in his budget that was pulled out that would have been more directed at middle class families, and it would have been more sustainable, whereas Republicans had it was funded by one-time only money. So, again, it takes some bipartisan pushing and pulling on these bills that we would have to see how exactly it is designed to see if there is support, if it is one that's sustainable and responsible.
Well, let's work in a call here on medical marijuana. Zach is joining us from Milwaukee on that. Zach, hi.
Hi. Well, I was just calling to say I actually have been using medical cannabis for several years now, which you can provide for yourself with a little bit of initiative. And anyway, what I wanted to say is it sounds to me it's just one senator is holding up this legislation. And how is that possible? Why? Well, I mean, it's possible because he is the I think the head of the Senate. But anyway, thank you.
Zach, thanks for the call. And State Senator Zach is questioning the politics on this.
Yeah, well, it is true. Senator Fitzgerald, the majority leader, he has expressed his opposition to it. I don't know where it falls within his caucus, if there are many other senators, Republican senators, that also support his position and are opposed to it. But we do know that Senator Fitzgerald has expressed his opposition to it. He is also now has an eye on running for Congress. And so that, of course, may be an issue, kind of making sure that his issue is confirmed on a position that he has. But I think if we could have a debate on this, I think that there are reasonable positions on it. But yes, that is the power of leadership. That is the power of the majority, that you could block an issue coming forward that does have strong public support. We have seen 83% of the public supports medical cannabis. We've seen that through Marquette Law studies or polls and things like that. So it does come down to the power of the majority and the power of the majority leader.
Senator Schilling, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Jennifer Schilling is a Democrat representing Wisconsin's 32nd Senate District, which includes La Crosse. Just ahead, we hear why an author moved his family from the Baltimore suburbs to rural Minnesota, an area he previously called the absolute worst place to live in America. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is the State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.